Good afternoon. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 2:33, November 5th, 2007. We're going to work on a topic that we've all seen, most of us have seen before. Joining me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Dyson. And we're going to work on some conceptual issues today concerning how our oil production tax has flowed through the state's system and how some of the calculations are done. What we're doing here is laying the groundwork for tomorrow and the following day as we get into the subject at hand. We have a new member from that wasn't at the Senate Finance table during the PPT writing of the bill, Senator Thomas from Fairbanks. And we also have with us Senator Huggins, who was here under the old PPT and has attended every committee meeting that the bill is in process through this year. And then the remaining members were either at the finance table or on other committees that dealt with the subject matter. This is a, on the surface, a very simple issue. And when we move off of the surface, it becomes a very complex issue with all the moving parts that we have to deal with as we change one area of our tax collection or our revenue collection. It has effects down in on other areas. So what we're going to do is go through some of the government take, or another way of phrasing it, how we split the value of our natural resources between ourselves, the federal government, and the explorers or developers and major multinational oil companies that are in the state harvesting our assets. We're going to go through the government take issue, and we will look at how it pertains to Alaska over the next few days and other oil basins around the world. And when we boil it back to Alaska, where the revenue comes into the Treasury, there's basically four main groups. There's royalties, which feed into the permanent fund. There's property tax, a corporate income tax, and the production tax, or commonly known as the PPT. The existing PPT structure, we're going to take a look at that in detail on the pay attention to the cash flows. One of the concerns that I have is that we get so caught up in sometimes the minute detail of the issue, we forget to take a look at the macro effects of what we're doing, and the concern I have is we do not end up shorting the Treasury inadvertently. We're going to also touch on some lease expenditures, operating and capital costs. We're going to go back, take a look at the old PPT bill and the fiscal note that was put together under that bill, what we were expecting at the finance table for PPT to produce, and why there's a variance over what is being forecasted by the Department of Revenue. And in that, we're going to be taking a look at the operating and capital costs, which around the globe has changed substantially in a very short time of 2 or 3 years, and we'll have discussions here at the table on how we put the state of Alaska in a position that we can protect the people's resource and still have a viable and expanding industry. We're going to go over some of the base tax issues within PPT, which is commonly referred to on the street as the 22.5 or 25 or some other tax rate. Just as important, if not more important, in higher oil price scenarios is the progressivity or the surcharge, which is an added tax on top of the base tax. And we're going to discuss the trigger, which is a starting mechanism, the slope or the speed at which the surcharge escalates, and then some kind of indexing methodology so we can have a tax structure that will prevail over time, depending on or would enable it to respond to changing market conditions, so we don't have to come here every year or every other year and deal with changes that we could deliver to the industry. What they want is stability. So we're going to try to do that. We're going to also look at credits, which is the stimulative part of PPT. And we're going to go into the capital credits, which are 20%, and there hasn't been much discussion of that particular issue, but we're going to touch on that. We're going to put numerics on the transitional investment credit, which is another sub-area of credits, the explorer and small producers incentives within PPT, and the net operating loss carryforwards, and the timing of credits and incentives. And there's been some interest by the administration that we review and possibly alter some of those. And we're also going to look at the tax administration, filing penalties, tax auditing windows, et cetera. There is a concern from the Department of Revenue that they do not have the tools that they feel they need to protect the state's treasury. So we're going to take a look at those tools and see if we can't come up with some help for the commissioner to be able to do his charge, which is look after the treasury. And then we'll look at some other issues or aspects of the oil tax regime as we go through it. We're going to try to stay concentrated on the tax collection or the value that the citizens of the state get for their resource, and from there work backwards into the much smaller details as far as monetary wise, but maybe a big political or emotional issue. But with the very short period of time we have here in the special session, we do not want to take our eye off the Treasury and end up here within a year doing other alterations. With that, we're going to have a topic of discussion today. We have with us Commissioner Pat Galvin, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and with him from Gaffney, Klein & Associates, Richard Ruggiero and Bob George. They're both here, and they're going to take us through a presentation on government take and how that works, and then they're going to flow through some numeric examples on the PPT tax structure and how the mechanics of that work. And we're going to tomorrow continue that exploration, so by the end of tomorrow the committee members should all be familiar with the mechanics of the process. So as we start going into these individual areas and moving particular levers and turning knobs, we'll all have a pretty good estimate what effects we're talking about, so we don't have to stop and have runs of and endless runs on the economic analysis. But we will have final outcome of this process here sometime at the end of the week, first of next week. The consultant is running analysis for us, so we're looking at dollars and percentage impacts on the treasury. With that, Commissioner Galvin, you have a presentation, and if we can just have a brief at ease, we'll drop the screen and you can. On the record. Commissioner Galvin, if you'd go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and also your compatriot there, when he starts in, he can get on the record also and take us through your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Today we're going to be talking about as the chairman said, look at, first off, oil's importance to the state revenue picture, showing you the different slices that come in, and again, going through the different parts of the oil revenue picture. Then we're going to turn to looking at the economics of the oil revenue from the perspective of the producer, how the cash flow comes in and the different places where the cash flow is going out, and in the end, what's left for the producer. And we're going to be looking at it through the metrics of two different perspectives. The reference to the Senate CS is the CS that was passed out of the Senate Judiciary. I understand it's not yet before you, but that's just a point of reference to show two different perspectives on the way that the economics work. Then we're going to turn to flip that around and look at it from the perspective of the government and the share that the state is taking of the various revenue streams. So turning to the state picture, as the chair indicated, the oil revenue for the state comes in four primary categories: royalty, property tax, production tax, and state income tax. On the royalty side, the amount is going to be based upon the gross value at the point of production. This is generally can be referred to as the value of the barrels less the transportation cost. So you're deducting both the cost of moving it down the Trans-Alaska pipeline and generally the cost of shipping it on tankers to market, usually on the west coast of the U.S. This rate is established, the actual royalty rate is established in the leases themselves, and they're subject to the contract provisions. They're not something that the state can adjust. It is an agreement between the state and the leaseholders as to what that rate would be. For the most part, we generally characterize the rate as 12.5% because that's the predominant rate for the leases that result in the bulk of the production from the North Slope. And so that's the number that we generally use when we talk about the royalty rate. Property taxes are based upon the value of the oil-producing properties. And that's a calculation, an appraised value, that looks at the depreciation of the investment costs as well as the value of the assets for the expected remaining life, combination of these factors. The state property tax system is divided between what's going to come in to the municipalities in which this property is located as well as to the state. The state sets it at 20 mils for all oil producing properties. That's the maximum rate. The state established that in statute. The local government can establish a mill rate within their areas, but it has to be the mill rate for the entire all property within that municipality, and they can basically take as much of that 20 mils as they deem the rate that they're going to set for all property within their municipality. The remainder goes to the state. Production tax is what we're talking about here primarily today. It's the rate this the tax system that the state puts in place for as a sovereign for the removal of all oil and gas resources from any lands within the state. One important distinction between royalty and production tax is that royalty is only the state-owned resources. It only comes from the oil and gas produced from state lands. Production tax applies to all oil and gas within the state. Currently, the production tax is based upon the company's net cash flow with the reduction in the tax base based upon operating expenditures as well as capital expenditures, that reinvestment that provides both a deduction and a credit. Then finally, we have the state income tax. It's a corporate tax solely, and we have a separate separation of the calculation method between corporations that are oil producers and those that are not, with oil producers resulting in what's referred to as an apportionment method, where you are looking at their worldwide profits, and then establishing what Alaska's portion of those would be based upon a number of different metrics, and that results in the state corporate income tax for the oil producers. Next slide.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to wait for questions or take them as we go?
We can go ahead and take your question, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I have two in order. Is there any real difference between a severance tax and a production tax?
For the most part, no. It's just a matter of how sort of the role of the state in. I think we can probably, for the ease of dialogue, just consider them to be equivalent.
Yeah, sometime I'd enjoy what the technical difference is. It doesn't have to be now.
Okay.
The other question is, when you were talking about the income tax, you used the phrase, we figure out what portion would be applicable to Alaska or something. Could you explain what you do?
Well, you would basically look at the percent of the corporation's total. We look at employees, we look at volume of production, value of the production, and what you are using are these different methods of saying, okay, Alaska represents X percent of this corporation's oil and gas operations. And you use a number of different factors to kind of blend that to represent how much of their worldwide profit should be attributable to their Alaska operations based upon these other proxies. And that then filters back into what we use as their income that then is applied the rate, the corporate tax rate is applied against.
If I may follow up, so is that set in statute?
Yes.
That's how we do it. And so the state does that analysis and makes their decision and then taxes the company based on that percentage of their worldwide income that we attribute to this operation.
Right. We use that method to determine what we believe is their Alaska share of their overall production.
And do they have any appeal of that?
Well, sure. They have appeal rights as they would on any tax system, administrative appeal and otherwise.
Yeah. And do they ever come back and say, no, here's the books. Here's what we spend and make and profit in.
It's not. Because of the way that you are calculating the share, you're using fairly bright line standards. You're not looking at, for example, what their operating expenditures are in Alaska compared to worldwide. So we're not getting down to that level of audit requirements. You're looking at number of employees. You're looking at overall gross production value. And those are fairly easily determinable factors. And so there's not the same level of auditing that you might find, for example, in comparing to the production tax.
Okay,
because we want to move on, but go ahead and follow up.
And your system is sophisticated enough that if one of these companies had all their purchasing and all their administrative services down in America, but a portion of those served their Alaskan operations, it picks that up?
Well, frankly, I'm not as familiar. I can't answer that myself. We could probably get some answers for you in terms of the actual apportionment method, how we decide individual employees and their allocable time. I don't have that information.
All right. Thank you.
With us today, Senator Green has joined us from the beginning, along with Senator Gary Stevens. And we're going to, some of these other items, as mentioned earlier by Senator Dyson, we're going to go into more detail in the future. Today, we're trying to get an overview of how the process works and all the different moving parts before we start going in and start moving the different knobs around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on this next slide, we're showing the, from a truly high level, all the money that's coming into the state, which comprises both what's generally referred to as restricted and unrestricted revenue. Restricted meaning that it's designated for a particular purpose and is not available primarily to the legislature to appropriate rate each year. And we have investment that's restricted that's made up of, I think, both permanent fund and non-permanent fund money that is kept within the investment area that's restricted for purpose designated in the statutes. We have the federal restricted, which are the federal monies that come in for particular purposes that the state can't redirect. Then we've got the oil restricted. You see that the 5% down there, those are the oil revenues that are going, that are royalty monies that are going directly into the permanent fund and to the school funds. And we'll have another slide on that in a moment. And then the oil unrestricted, the $4.3 billion representing 36% of our overall income. And if we go to the next slide. When you're looking at just the unrestricted income and looking at just that piece of the petroleum, recognizing that, again, those different parts, the, again, this is just the unrestricted portion. Royalty accounts for $1.6 billion or 35%. The production tax on the opposite side, 47%, $2.3 billion. And then the corporate income tax is 12%. When you get down to the property tax, it's split between the municipalities. They get the 5%, and the state is bringing in the 1%. All those together on the state side represent the $4.6 billion, and then you add in the $300 million for the municipal property tax.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick question. Mr. Commissioner, so the $4.6 billion does not include the portion of the property tax that's going to the munis, or does include?
It does not.
Does not. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. We will include that when we start getting into the government share,
yes,
producer share issue, but on this chart it's not. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Galvin, the property tax is upwards of $300 million, right? Total, forget about the state part, just total, and the state get 1% of that? Is that accurate?
I no, the in a later slide, what you'll see is the breakdown between the state's bringing in about $60 million, and so I believe that the $300 million represents the municipal portion, and the state portion is about $50 million on top of that.
Okay. You know, and these I'd are FY07. To see what that number is.
Okay, these are FY07 numbers. Right.
Yep.
$54 million, but we can get okay. that out of the revenue source book. Go ahead.
So going to, this represents on, again, backing out to just unrestricted, total unrestricted, recognizing that oil represents 88% of that unrestricted total. So now I'm going to turn it over to Mr. George to talk about the sharing of the cash flows that come in as a result of oil and gas sales.
So just before we dive in there, let's just go back to that last slide. The 88% or the $4.3 billion varies year by year depending on volume and price, but that's the number, the percentages that continues to pop up in conversations in the legislature and in the press of 80 to 90% of our state revenue coming from the oil and gas, and particularly the oil industry.
That's correct.
And that is why we're here today. Senator Elton.
But I just want to make sure, I mean, this does not count the unrestricted income that comes in from the permanent fund.
That is correct as well. That this is the unrestricted revenues. So it's only that portion that is available for appropriation on an annual basis. You go back to three slides and you can see the sliver that's coming out to go directly to the permanent fund.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman, Senators, for the record, my name is Bob George from Gaffney Klein & Associates.
What I was going to do was, as Commissioner Galvin had outlined at the beginning, was to walk through for financial year 2009, and 2009 was chosen because that's the first full year that would forecast would be available for, where you didn't have transitional impacts, and just for comparison purposes would make it easier. But to forecast the revenues that would flow from expected production and compare it between the existing PPT system and the proposed changes in place from the Senate Judiciary CS. What I have on this first slide, and I'll try and walk you through it line by line because there is a lot of information on there, but this is assuming the existing PPT system. And what we start from on the top line here is what is called sales revenue, and that is $18 billion, just a little bit above there, and that reflects the sale of 749,000 barrels a day at the department's official forecast price for 2009 of $66.30 ANS West Coast. And so the first column is in millions of dollars is the numbers that are either income or cost in there. The second column, headed percentage, is the percentage of the individual numbers as a percentage of the sales revenue. And I'll point that out right now because in a later slide, where we start looking at profits as opposed to sales revenue, the percentage will be done on profits. I don't want anyone to misunderstand that. And in the third column there is all those numbers reduced to a dollars a barrel basis. So as you can see on the first row there, we have sales revenue of just over $18 billion. That represents 100% of the sales revenue, and that represents $66.30 per barrel. Then as you move down on there are line items in there for shipping, for TAPS pipeline, and for royalty. And we've also highlighted an issue under PPT for the TAPS pipeline. And the number that is shown in this slide is the actual cost of running TAPS. And it's highlighted because in calculating production tax, PPT, there is a higher deduction allowed, which is in the order of $5 a barrel. And that is one of the items that changes as you go to the Senate Judiciary, and we chose to show it like this to make those comparisons slightly easier. But the number would be, instead of 246 a barrel, would be somewhere in the order of $5 a barrel, so perhaps about double that they would be able to take as a deduction in calculating production tax. When you remove the shipping, the TAPS charge, and the royalty, you end up with a gross value at the point of production here of just a little bit under $15 billion. And that represents some 82% of the ultimate sales price in there. We've then taken away, in the next section, moving down, three more items are listed. One is the capital expenditure, listed there as CapEx, of about $2 billion. The operating costs, labeled OpEx, of a very similar number of about $2 billion. And a property tax number of a little bit over $300 million. And when you net that out of the calculation, you end up with the net value at the point of production of about $10.5 billion. And it is on that net value at the point of production that PPT is assessed. The total forecast PPT under the department's model, based on this assumed level of production and $66.30 ANS West Coast, would yield production tax of nearly $1.7 billion. Now, below that, in the italics, we've broken that out into various components as to how you get there. And that we've broken it out between the base production tax, which is assessed at a rate of 22.5%. There is then the progressivity component, which increases 0.25% every time when the net value at the point of production exceeds $40 per barrel. And then there are some deductions in there for small producer credits, for exploration incentive credits, for capital credits, and also for the tie credits. And the tie credits is one of the issues which changes under the Senate Judiciary proposal. That leaves pre-corporate income tax revenue of about $8.8 billion to the producers, which is just slightly under half of the total sales value at the that we started with. And then there are two more line items in there. There is the state income tax and federal income tax, which leaves the producers in this case here with about just under $5.5 billion or about $20 per barrel. If I move on from this slide, I've then got a comparison of the numbers, or at least I have the numbers laid out under the Senate Judiciary CS, and the slide that follows this will then compare them side by side. So perhaps it would be easier just to go straight on to the next slide after this rather than running through the line items, where we can look at the comparison side by side on there. And you have, in this one, it's exactly the same table layout. The first column in there is the numbers you saw.
Senator Melton.
Before, and I apologize, Mr. George, before we move on to that next slide, if you could go back to the producer revenues under the PPT.
PPT.
And you show down toward the bottom less state income tax of 763 or 4%. On this chart, which is page 5, it seems to suggest that the state income tax is 12%. So I guess I'm a little bit confused, and it's probably my confusion, how you get to 763, because if 12% of 8.8 seems it would be higher than 763.
The 12% is 12% of all state revenue, as opposed to this is 4% of the sales revenue for it's you're taking this a similar number and it's a percentage of a wholly different number. With the pie chart, you're comparing the state income tax as a percentage of state revenues.
Okay.
On this slide, it's that sales tax amount as a percentage of oil sales for the company.
Okay.
And so they're two different numbers that we're comparing what that state income tax is a portion of.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To give me a point of reference, at $66.30 at ANS West Coast, what would the production tax be under the governor's modified PPT as compared to the $1.7 billion?
Senator Hoffman, we have in here under the Senate Judiciary numbers. I did not
understand
have the numbers
that. I'm trying to get a point of reference to find out what the governor proposed, which was the reason why we're down here. So I need that point of reference.
We will provide that to you, but
you don't have that.
I do not have it to hand.
I just had a whisper in my ear, 2369, and I'm not sure which number that's a reference to.
Or maybe
that's instead of the 1693
2.3 billion
production tax value, it's 2369.
Maybe 2.3 billion.
2.3 billion.
Commissioner, maybe you could rerun these tables, because we don't have that bill on the table even before us today. You could rerun these tables under the governor's numbers and get into the
yep, chair. We'll make that available to you.
What we're interested in here is the mechanisms of how it works, and then we'll get into turning the knob some other time. Go ahead and continue.
As I was just about to move on to compare the two, perhaps it would also be helpful to clarify the key differences in assumptions before I move on to that. So under the Senate Judiciary CS, the primary differences are that the base rate of production tax moves up from 22.5% to 25%. The progressivity starts at a cash flow per barrel of $30 rather than $40 as exists under PPT. And the progressivity is 0.4% per dollar a barrel by which the net cash flow exceeds 30, as opposed to 0.2% by which it exceeds 40, which it is under PPT. And lastly, the elimination of the tie credits.
Let's continue on to page 13.
Hey, 13?
13.
Okay.
Talk about the government share issue.
Right. So what we have on page 13 is the same numbers from the tables you've seen before, but just focusing on the government and the Alaska share of those numbers. So we're still based on the same $66.30 a barrel and 749,000 barrels a day. And this table starts with the net cash flow number by which we're meaning it's the ultimate sales price less the costs to get to this point. So this represents divisible income, if you like, between the producer and the state. And in the headline on this, we walked through under PPT previously, the producers would get $20, just a little over that per barrel, and the state. The government overall, that is the state of Alaska and the federal government, would get 58% or a little bit over $27 a barrel. Now, if we look at the division of the total government take, of that 58%, 20% would represent federal income tax. And then you'd have the division of the remaining 38%, which is retained by Alaska. On that, 16% would be royalty, 2% would be, actually there is a mislabel in that table as I see it now, for which I would apologize to you. The 2% number should be property tax. And the line item that is petroleum tax should be production tax of 13%, and then the state income tax, the $763 million, would be 6%. So, in total, those four items make up 38% of the total profitability of operations in 2009, 38 to the state, 20 to the for federal income tax, for total government take of 58% on it. If we look at this under the...
We'll skip that chart. We're not really interested in the diving into that particular CS. We don't have it on the table. What we're trying to do is get the flow of the process here, and we'll take up those numbers later.
Well, all the remaining slides, I think, sit in with comparisons in there. But if you
can isolate and just talk about
that. If we look at on slide 15 here, which is two bars on there, the 58, the left-hand side is just a representation of the total government take, showing the breakout between the production tax, the royalty, the property tax, and the state income tax making up 38%, and then the federal income tax making up a further 20% in there.
So how does this stack up relative to other basins when we look at our share between us, the federal government, and the producers?
If you're looking in other places around the world, some indicative ranges might be that in the UK sector of the North Sea, the older fields would be paying 75% of profits to the government, and newer fields would be paying 50%. If you look in Norway, they would be paying 78% as a state take in there, made up of two separate taxes.
and Alberta. Do you happen to have that one memorized? That's
I do not know the latest mix of numbers within Alberta since they have proposed the changes, but over the up until the existing proposed changes in place, that'll I think kick in 2009 or so, and it was in the mid 40s was what was held to be the Alberta state take.
Okay. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Commissioner Galvin, the shot group is all over the place right now about government take, Alaska's take. My question for you, though, as Commissioner, since you know the bill, what is administration's target? What's the goal? I mean, we're within the comfort zone.
What we've looked at is primarily looking at the balance, not necessarily on a take, other than using that to make sure we're not getting outside of sort of this worldwide range, but we look primarily at Alaska investment opportunities and ensuring that the rates that we would set would not impinge what we would want to see as the investment opportunities that we'd like to see continued. And so we've broken that in between the new fields that we anticipate coming online and the legacy fields, and we're trying to reach that balance. When you get down to what the share should be, we were asked to present that. It wasn't necessarily what we used as our driver. We used it as the sort of secondary. Once we kind of found where we were on the investment side, then we wanted to match it up and make sure that we weren't getting outside of sort of a world norm.
Yeah. Well, I still don't know what the comfort zone is when the administration.
Well, I think actually it was bracketed by what Bob said. We see that our peers, primarily on the royalty tax side, are generally going to be bracketed by somewhere between the UK and Norway.
And theirs was 74% and 50%.
50 and 78.
Right. I think that's North Sea was 78.
In the UK, older fields have two taxes that apply to them that in aggregate would result in 75% going to the government. New fields, it would be 50%. They only have the one tax. Norway is 78 and two taxes.
Right. Yeah. And
go ahead, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, if I might. You know, I've listened to the debate and the term balance, and it's often I hear a referral back to the gross floor. You know, I'm of the opinion that when in talking to people in the legislature that they just dismissed the gross floor, that it was just kind of a token that was out there. It was dysfunctional. And if we're trying to balance based on, and I hear the reference of, because the gross floor fell out, we've got to balance it. And the feeling I get, it was a dysfunctional element of the bill originally.
Senator Huggins, I recognize that the legislature decided to move past the gross floor. We didn't see it as dysfunctional. It was recognition. Well,
if I can stop you, though, the people that I talked to, there wasn't any alliance to the gross floor because it was an element that didn't have any merit in the context of the economics of tax.
Senator Huggins, we saw that it did have merit, that it represented a mechanism for the state to ensure that it provided a revenue stream during times of low prices, and rather than taking it as a higher amount when the prices were high and ensuring that we would save that for when the prices were low, it was ensuring that we would get a revenue stream when the prices were low. Now, there were different metrics and different presentations that were done by the industry that were showing that they felt that it was impinging on their investment decision making. We felt that it was right at the appropriate balance where their decision making shouldn't have been drastically affected. And I think we provided some representations of that. My understanding from talking to legislators was that they felt that they would rather take a different approach, which was to take more on the times when the prices were high and save that for when the prices were low, rather than having a mechanism that provided the revenue at that time. And it was just a choice.
I understand. My party final comment was nobody's come to me and says we have to have the gross floor. I didn't see any allegiance to that. And I just leave it on the table at that.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is your first PPT question. You're probably going to have lots more if you're like any of the rest of us.
There'll be a variety of them. Hopefully they make some kind of sense to people. One concern I have is when, as we're talking now, and a lot of the discussions that have taken place so far have been over estimates, and the estimate even used here at $66 a barrel is a number that we only eclipsed a little over, well, about 2 years ago, I guess, when we eclipsed $60 a barrel. So my concern is that when you evaluate those and you use the different proposals that have come forth, the numbers seem astronomical in some people's minds. You know, wow, a tax increase of $1.5 billion or $2 billion based on this. So to me, and it may not be helpful to anybody else, but to me it might be helpful to look back at what historically happened in a particular year and apply, just for my thinking, ACES, PPT, and even the ELF for that purpose, to see what would have come in under those real terms at that point in time. Because I'm not convinced, although the price is $95 a barrel at this point in time, that it may not go down at something that, and so we're considering progressivity at high numbers, thinking that we're gonna, you know, take the cream off the top, and that may not necessarily be the case. So just for me, maybe no one else is interested in it, but that's something that I might like to see.
Commissioner Galvin, you wanna respond?
Senator Thomas, through the chair. We agree 100% that you need to look at it from a full range of different prices that we may be experiencing. We're hoping that this tax system is one that we will live with for many years to come without having to adjust it, and therefore we think it's critical that in the analysis you're going to look at it at a full range of potential prices. And I believe even in the package you have before you, we provide that information across a wider range. What we have to do sometimes when we do these snapshots is, in order to just keep the conversation moving forward, pick a point in time and show you a comparison in more detail, and then we step back, show it a little bit less detail, but then across a number of different price ranges. And so with this particular one, we're picking our forecasted number, but we do recognize that that a critical part of the discussion is going to be looking at it across a wide range.
Just one last shortcut.
Go ahead.
This is not a criticism of what you've done. It's just that when the numbers are mentioned, some people pick up only on the huge number that they hear and apply that to a huge increase on the industry, not really taking the reference of that it's being calculated on $60 or $80 or even $90 a barrel oil. So that's my only concern, is that people will pick up that snapshot and say, wow, look what they did. So we may still end up doing it, but you know, I mean, be fair.
Go ahead and continue, please.
This next slide is dealing with the impact of change between the PPT's existing PPT system and the Senate one. And similarly, this chart is a bar graph of comparison, but again, if I focus on the left-hand side, and my apologies because up on the big screen here it's hard to see a couple of the numbers, but basically that under PPT there you have a tax that in total would collect in the 2009 scenario $8.63 per barrel on the base from the base 22.5% and 55 cents a barrel from the progressivity. But netted out of that would be $1.84 in credits, a further 74 cents a barrel in Thai credits, and a further 58 cent adjustment coming from the greater deductibility on the TAPS tariff than the actual costs in there.
So then, is it fair to say that as we need to be real careful when we look at all things, including the marine transportation and the TAPS tariffs, we look at our different credits, even some of the smaller ones, if they're an NOL credit or a transition credit, all of these have multiple compounding effects versus just the one little line item that we think we're changing?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. What we wanted to show with this is to recognize that there are aspects of the tax that we're talking about that are increasing the amount to the state, and there are those that are going to decrease it. And
that when we end up talking about the revenue picture, we're talking about the net of the two, and so you have to recognize which part of the machine you're adjusting when you're adjusting one aspect of it.
The last, this slide and the next one, which is the last slide, again run a comparison, but they compare in two areas. They show PPT on here at different oil prices in there. So at $40 a barrel, at $60 a barrel, at $80 a barrel, and $100 a barrel. And in this particular chart here, this is looking at what portion of those prices go to satisfy costs, which is the sort of yellow, mustardy-colored part of the bar at the top in there. What part is retained by the producers as their net cash flow? That is in the green. There's the sort of dark blue-gray, the lighter blue-gray color, which is the federal income tax portion, and the dark blue part at the bottom, which is Alaska's total take on there. And as you see, as you move from $40 to $60 to $80 to $100, costs remain relatively constant within there in this particular snapshot. And you can see they are a smaller and smaller portion of the overall sales revenue in there. And as you move through there, so the proportions that are taken by Alaska and the federal government increase as you go from 40 to 100, but also the companies are also receiving increased revenue across that time period as well. The next slide, which is the last slide we have up there, is just stripping the costs out of that top portion and therefore looking at this as a share of profit in there. And as you can see, at $40 a barrel, the producers take about 40% of the profit, and Alaska and the federal income tax takes about 60% of the profit under PPT. And as you move out to $100 a barrel, the Alaska moves up from just about 40% to 45% perhaps in there. Federal income tax takes the total there to somewhere in the order of 65%, and the producers retain about 35% of the profit in there.
We have, as we all know, time constraints dealing with this special session, and we're going to have to keep things fairly fluid as we move forward the next few days as we try to make sure we manage the clock and get our work done in ample time to get the bill across the floor. So there wasn't time for us to review the presentation today. So there's items in the presentation that aren't really germane to the discussion of today. And I apologize for that, but that's just, we'll probably have other instances like that as we go forward as we try to not lose any time to get things done. But if I could have the commissioner, if he could rerun this presentation with the PPT and then the governor's proposed bill, it would be a better reference point.
We would be happy to.
Yeah, and then we can flow through. I think the item when we get into that was skipped over, but there's an issue here dealing with impacts on shippings and tariffs and other areas outside of the generally recognized arena of impacting progressivity. When we get into the progressivity discussion, we can have some of these items brought out and discussed in more detail. So I don't want to get impression from any of the members that we are glossing over or not going to address these particular items. It's just the timing of when we do it. We're going to do things on a issue-by-issue basis as we try to package this up the next several days. So we'll have time to address that and deal with it. But Senator Allen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And kind of to that point, Commissioner, I don't know what the instructions were, but am I to infer by looking at the presentation by the department today that because there were no comparisons with ACES, that the governor has kind of moved on and is comfortable with, I mean, you don't mention ACES at all. The comparisons are all done between PPT and the Senate Judiciary Committee version. Am I to infer that you're comfortable then with the Senate Judiciary and you've moved on from ACES?
We're comfortable with either one. And what we were trying to do is just recognize that the discussion is advanced and we wanted to continue the advancement. We didn't want to give the impression that the governor was saying it's aces or nothing. We have come here from the very beginning recognizing that we're here to work with the legislature on determining the best package to go forward, and we did not come in with the position that it had to be this combination. And so we were basically, in putting this together, we are trying to acknowledge that the Senate has moved beyond the original proposal, and that was why we put it together the way we did.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Commissioner.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tie credits. I would be interested in seeing what elements that have emerged over time that the administration is supportive of, and those that, for one reason or another, that there are still questions or needs further clarification.
Okay. Well, with the tie credits, Senator Huggins, our position has remained consistent throughout that they shouldn't be allowed from the point, the effective date of the bill, and that's consistent with the keeping with the current version and what came out of Senate Resources. Our position hasn't changed on that. But on other things, I mean, we're happy to talk about where we are on a variety of issues.
Would you say that one more time?
With regard to tie credits,
right.
Our position has remained that no one should be earning tie credits forward from the effective date of the bill. And that's been our position all along, and that's reflected in the current, the CS that came out of Senate Resources as well as the one that came out of Senate Judiciary.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll go into those credits, like I mentioned earlier, in the next couple of days, each individual credit, and try to put numerics on it so there's a clear understanding at the table what we were under the impression that we were going to have impacted the Treasury, what actually is impacting the Treasury, and then what you feel is coming attractions for us if we do not change the current policy.
Yes, sir.
That is all the slides we have prepared here.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your presentation. We are going to go into this topic in more detail tomorrow as far as we lay out kind of a income statement approach to the PPT, and then we're going to take up a bill, and then we're going to start going through the process of itemizing these individual issues.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
I just have one question of interest, and that is on the progressivity. And I think the one of the major differences between the bill that the governor introduced and the one that came out of the other committee, the Judiciary Committee, are markedly different. And I was wondering what the administration's position on progressivity is. You know, I think that the progressivity was at 0.4 in the last bill, and I think at our first hearings in the beginning of the session, Dr. Van Meer says that he could support something possibly as high as 3.75, and I was wondering if there's a range that this administration has some comfort level with, or is it the level that was in the original PPT bill?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. As we've mentioned, with the original bill, we had a combination of a gross tax floor that was to protect the state on the low end and what we considered to be a more modest progressivity, which was based upon a 0.2 slope starting at a $30 net margin. As we move forward, as mentioned in a previous answer, we recognize the legislature wants to take a different approach, would rather not go for the floor, and would rather go for a higher progressivity and save the amount for the times when prices are low. That's a reasonable approach. Within that context, we're comfortable with where Senate Judiciary came out with the 0.4. We think that's probably in the balance of things, if you're going to lose the floor, about, it seems an appropriate place to be, given some other things that other models that we run and looked at the impact of it. But I think it's something that I'm sure I know and that this committee is going to be looking at closely, and we look forward to having those discussions in terms of the other options within that range.
Well, you know, I think that when you look at the difference, and maybe we can get into this a little later, but just a side note, you know, I think that the difference between the floor being eliminated on an annual basis may range, depending on the price range, between $100 and $200 million. But the progressivity at $100, the difference there between the original PPT and what was passed out by the other committee is a staggering $3 billion. So there seems to be a major shift. To me, it seems if the administration is moving in that direction, there's major dollar differences in the two.
Senator Hoffman, to the chair, I think we can look at the numbers and show, I mean, we can look at the different combinations. What we recognized is that in the range of sort of the prices that we believe are, you know, what we see is maybe about a $50 price to $100 price area of discussion, that when you look at the trade-off between the floor and the accelerated progressivity, the floor, we were looking at the floor higher than the $200 million. We were looking at the saving, you know, protecting closer to $400 million at times. And with our progressivity compared to the what came out of the Senate, I think you're right, that it's bringing in more than that on the up end. And the question becomes, are we committed to saving that so that we have it in the times when we need it? And the combination of within the dialogue that we've had with the legislature over the period of the session, we've gotten back two messages. One is that the legislature feels more comfortable not worrying about the floor, but going for the steeper progressivity with a commitment of saving that money. And both of those things we're comfortable with.
But just one more point, I guess. The floor, as I said, maybe had about $200 million there. So to make them equal at the higher end, if we save $200 million on a yearly basis, there would be a net wash. But at $100, which it seems to me we're right around the corner of, you know, the difference is $3 billion. So the difference being a mere $2.8 billion, that's a staggering difference to me.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, when we were putting our materials together, when we were evaluating the metrics of this, we were back in July, August, September. The price was in the 70s, and people were talking about it at historic levels. And our numbers are all run with that being the range that we expected to be, and that was the world that we were making decisions in. And as Senator Thomas said, people are going to recognize that if we base our decision on a $100 world, we're going to look sort of short-sighted. And so it would have been a very difficult argument to come in and say that we made our proposal based upon an expectation that we're going to be living in a $90 to $100 world. And so we made our recommendation, we made our decision in terms of this balance, looking at what would at that point have been a $50 to $70 world. Now, we're at a different place now, but I don't think we should all think that we're in a whole different world. We're only 2 months into this new $80 to $90 world, and we could be a month from now back into a $70 world and all saying, boy, that was a little dream that we had back there. So I think we all need to keep our focus on what is the
the reasonable range of expected prices and base our decision on that and go forward. And if we're fortunate as a state that we end up with a higher return, great. But I don't think we should base our decisions on an expectation we're going to be there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Robin. When we look back at the previous administration and the process we went through under PPT, we spent a lot of time in the 20, particularly the $30 to $60 range, and the $60 was the high range at that time that we spent a lot of time on. Now the new administration was caught in the rewrite and apparently in around a $70 range, and now we're up in the low $90 range. And I think what we're going to spend some time on at the table here is trying to come up with a PPT that will work in $150 oil and work in $50 oil, so we don't have to come back as year by year as we get these dynamic changes in prices and respond to it. So we will be taking time and looking at what would appear to be absurd oil prices at maybe 110 or 105 or some number, along with what do we do and how are we structured at $40 a barrel oil. So we want to spend a little bit of time in that far-reaching arena, and we'll all be punished at the fuel pump, but we'll be rewarded when we get our dividend check. Is there any closing comments from any committee members? Okay, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we're going to go again on the current PP structure. Again, this is going to be the current PP structure and how the tax computation works and how the revenue flows. So then we can start to get into the detail of how we can modify the revenue stream and better facilitate some of the issues at hand. Meeting adjourned.